Welcome to A Lot Going On with Raj Kotecha. We've got an incredible episode today, fully focused on the tech scene as I'm in Toronto, Canada. I was here for the Collision Conference, North America's biggest gathering of tech nerds and innovators. Joining me today is Adnan, all the way from Dubai. Adnan, what's good?
Pleasure to be here as always. Raj, I'm excited to hear about the last week, doing a lot of stuff and meeting a lot of people out in Toronto.
I know. It's true. I think what we'll do is we'll get the tech stuff out of the way. And then if we get time at the end, I'll just do a little bit more about out and about in Toronto and some of the bits and pieces that I've been doing. So what everyone's going to be wanting to know about is effectively what is going on with tech trends now. And unless you've been living under a rock, clearly it all comes down to AI. That's the biggest buzzword. My two big summaries from Collision is that, number one, much like the paradigm of technology, AI is expected to seep into most industries the same way that cloud has. You know, there are lots of companies now that need cloud storage. It exists, it works, and it's now a staple part of most companies' tech stacks. AI is going to be the same. One of the best takes that I heard was from Mustafa Suleiman. If you listen to the last episode of All In, they were discussing Mustafa. He is the co-founder of DeepMind, which got sold to Google in 2013 to help them figure out how to make YouTube recommendations. So all your YouTube recommendations are a result of DeepMind's AI. He is now with Inflection AI, which is he co-founded with Reid Hoffman, and they just raised $1.3 billion last week. So I got to spend a little bit of time with him. Let me just show you, Adnan.
Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah. So cool cat, man. Like cool kind of like brownish guy from the UK, and just had a cool vibe about him. But he made a good point when we were talking, which was that AI is effectively going to become much more like a website than something else. Which is that when you go to a company right now and you say, "Oh, I went to their website to check, and I went here and I went there," you'll just check with their AI, and eventually what will happen is that your AI, your personal AI, will check with their personal AI. So for everything that you need to do in the world, you'll interface with your AI, and then it will then fragment all of your requests, go to the AIs of all the other people that you need to deal with, your gas bill, your restaurant, your Uber, your this, that, your, you know, holiday planning, and it will come back to you and say, yeah, it's all sorted. And because your AI is learning from every single request you've done and all your tastes and preferences, along with the recommendations of all other AIs of all people, we're going to start to see like insane efficiencies when it comes to your AI as this kind of like floating personal assistant on your shoulder.
Yeah. There was a really nice note in the All In podcast where they talked about AI as a co-pilot, right? So it's essentially the person that knows you better than you know yourself and then just does everything for you.
Yeah.
But
what are your thoughts on AI as a website though? Like, you know, we talk about, I've been in the game long enough that it's like, oh, you need to have a website, you need to have a podcast, you need to have this. But the idea of building like a central intelligence that is interactive, similar to a human, it has all of your base company data, like your SOPs, you know, it's like a Notion, it's like a wiki, plus everything else, like connected into your suppliers and your whole supply chain. That concept blew my head off, to be honest. AI will be the modern website, the new website.
No, I think that blew my mind a little bit too as you were talking about it, because you think about what the template of the face of a company is. You know, at some point the number one was like the front door of the office, then it's a website, and now it's almost to that, you know, the template, like one pager landing page, which has a kind of a standard banner ad, then your little icons and your contact us and maybe click now to learn more. You may just get on a website and just have a single chat box, right? And you can say, hey, tell me about this company in 5 minutes, or give me put together a video of a company that explains what they do. So yeah, I think it's going to be the future. Mm. But my other question or thought is that they talked about in the All In podcast that each of these companies will have some form of wanting to either internally create their own AI, either within their HR team, sales teams, you know, operational teams. Like how does each company go about building their own AI that turns into this co-pilot that's internal or external facing? Or do they work with, you know, reputable companies to build like something, like get an enterprise software that comes in and does it for them?
That would be the hot thing. If somebody comes along, look, the same way that Squarespace says, this is Squarespace. Architecturally, we can present your information this way, but you need to populate it. Rather than populating with AI, you're going to be teaching. So when you convey your words from your mind into Squarespace or into WordPress, you're presenting your information that lives in your head. It's tacit and it becomes explicit. Mm-hmm. With AI, it's going to be hybrid tacit, which is that you will teach it and then it will continue to teach itself. And it will take all of your mm-hmm. customers' insights, all of your data. So if you look at what we do with My Friends, Your Friends, we could just ask AI, hey, you know, we're looking at doing something special for the medical community, for dentists. And AI will come back and be like, in the My Friends, Your Friends community, you've got 88 dentists, 65% women specializing in this. These are the kind of people that would be interested in, you know, sponsoring or helping participate with in the gig.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. It's really, really mind blowing because it affects anything to do with data and the triangulation of data, like taking different data sets and coming up with like a bunch of aha moments and conclusions. Yeah. It's really, 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 really interesting. And how it plays out and who's going to make what moves, we'll see. As you probably saw the back of the handkerchief maths that Chamath did, that this company's raise of 1.3 billion, but they could have a CapEx of 960 million. And when he announced that, when he was talking about that, guess who was on the front row? So let me just run the audio now or run the clip now. And then Adnan, I'll show it to you and then we'll just dub it in.
Building a cluster of around 22,000 H100s. This is approximately three times more compute than was used to train all of GPT-4. We'll have that online this year in October. So it's a pretty remarkable time. Speed and scale is what's going to really enable us to build a differentiated product.
You know what, as well, Adnan, it's weird because I do a lot of cool shit without sounding like an asshole. A lot of cool shit. This was really cool. Like being on the front row of the press conference, watching him like talk his talk and then having a quick conversation with him afterwards was a vibe. You know what I mean? Like really you felt like, I don't know how much closer you can get to what's happening with AI than just being around certain cats like this. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. I just do want to big up like Collision for the opportunity to come out and do that because it was fire, man. And it's so funny because it's like, not even the beginning of my notes. Like if you're looking on the video version of the notes right now, you'll see that I'm just scrolling through pages and pages of notes. So many so, in fact, that I had to actually take pictures of what it was I was looking at and then write the notes underneath just to act as an additional like mnemonic.
Yeah. Raj, I have a question there when you kind of played that video. For the average non-expert on AI, what are the true implications of having a compute power that's three times the size of what it was used to train GPT? Does it reduce the cost per hour of training? Does it allow more people access in the business? Like, does it purely just make the process quicker?
I mean, this is probably closer to an engineering question. If I was to guess, I would say it would be all about bandwidth and scaling for the number of people they want to use it. So if we saw when ChatGPT came out that there was load issues from the users, the load issues happened around a week into GPT 3.5. Yeah. And then we all got used to like the paying model where it's like, listen, if you put a couple of dollars in, $20 a month, you can have GPT-4 and that keeps it on the road. I think it's going to be for that. I think if they're really looking at something which is an active AI rather than a reactive AI, they're going to need that capacity. So at the moment, AI is a reactive thing, right? We go to ChatGPT, we go to Bard, and we input our requests, which, you know, Vic fantastically framed last time, is that if you want to get a 10 out of 10 result, you take ChatGPT to a 2, ChatGPT will bring you back a 7, and then you kind of finish it off, or 8. You just kind of quality assure check it. I think that's what it's going to be for. I think it's going to be for an AI that wakes up. Well, it doesn't wake up. It's constantly real time reviewing your calendar, looking at who you need to talk to, where you need to be. And it's going to be doing so much background processing. Maybe that's the way to look at it. The same way that your phone says, would you like to switch off certain apps?
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you want to go like low usage? And you go, yeah, I don't want all my apps to be refreshing. I don't want my emails to be pinging. I'll just get them when I need to refresh them. I think we're going to have the same relationship with AI, which is, do you want the kind of relationship with AI which costs, you know, $20 a month, where AI will just be there for you whenever you need it? Or do you want the AI that costs $60 a month, where AI is just constantly always on and proactively trying to get you ahead of your day?
Yeah. And another impact that I was thinking about as we were listening to the All In episode was, this is in relation to the whole company enterprise AI, either outward or inward facing. The biggest issue when I was working in corporate, which was one of the largest retailers in the US, and this is an issue of a majority of these large companies, is that as you grow, you end up having many more barriers or distance in communicating between teams. So that becomes your restrictor to quick growth. Very tangibly, that may mean that I'm working on a project that three other teams at some part of the business are already working on. Either I don't know about it, either I am looking for data that they may not have, or vice versa. And this creates a lot of friction that avoids the business moving forward or avoids things getting done. Mm-hmm. Now imagine if you had an AI, and I think this will be the case, that's internal facing, that has access to every piece of data, every folder, every initiative that's inputted in the system. And I can just ask, hey, I'm working on this new technology to add into this store. Which team has worked on this? And do they have any specific data to support it? So it allows you to better connect nodes within a business that's, you know, 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 people purely just working in the corporate office.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like what you've been doing with AI in CCA, right? Which is that you've allowed AI to run lockstep with certain processes inside our business, conversations, logging, things of that nature. And I went to that AI on my phone the other day, and I just started typing in words like Instagram, Facebook, video, podcast, YouTube. And now I can see how many times I've spoken about that with our clients and pull the themes out. I think it's going to be completely normal for you to say, hey, the way I can check your emails, you know, when you have an email, company email, especially in the corporate world, you'll know this, that there's a, when you sign up, they say, hey, listen, any company, any emails that you send using your company email account are property of the company. And they can check that, right? And that's fine. You know, sometimes people might order something on Amazon or whatever and use their company account, is no biggie. But the idea of every company now being able to record your call for quality assurance purposes, even between colleagues, and then have all of that audited and data and all that kind of stuff is quite scary. And because the thing about AI is, because there are so many use cases that all make sense hypothetically, that there are way more hypothetical use cases than there are established needs. So at some point, all the use cases will go to market because it's capitalism and everybody wants to come up with the best use case.
Mm-hmm.
And then the needs will become established. And honestly, man, there's not many ideas that I've come up with in terms of like the application of AI, but not many that I heard on stage at Collision that I don't see being helpful. Like, it's like, if AI can do it, why not? You know what I mean? Whatever that use case is, why not? And if we feel like it's doing too much, we just don't need to use it for that. You know, we don't use the web even today for everything. There are certain things that we still like to do manually. Yeah. So we will calibrate with AI how much we need from it. One thing that we know is that nobody likes to be completely served hand and foot.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's going to be a little bit of like, you're still going to want to do some things manually and you just won't give that to AI. So it was really, really incredible. And honestly, dude, it's affecting everything. Really, it's going to be the thing that continues to ring bells from an innovation and from a news cycle point of view for at least 2 years. So it's going to be very exciting. Now, how that collides with the US elections and things of that nature is still to be seen. It's fire.
So that was one theme, right? You said two themes, correct? Two core themes at Collision. Is that correct?
I don't know if I already covered the two core themes. One was AI and the other one was, did I say anything before that? I can't remember.
Yeah. Anyways, I think AI it probably is a part of the second theme anyways.
Yeah. Well, it's from a tech point of view, it's not, but I thought you'd find this interesting. So there's been a big growth in tech in one particular sector, which is called low code, no code. So for people that use apps like Notion, Squarespace, MailChimp, Eventbrite, apps that effectively allow you to put together a front end to do something with your clients or stakeholders or customers or whatever it may be, that area is growing significantly. Like the fact that you can build so many things now from an Eventbrite page, which we've been able to do for 15 years, which just collects your tickets and collects your ticket money, right through to Notion that effectively can put together like a relational database inside your business and a wiki and collect all your like standard operating procedures and things of that nature. That's growing. So Gartner said that 41% of non-tech workers inside organizations are looking at no-code tools, and 54% of Stripe customers are interested in no-code. And the reason is that because innovation and entrepreneurship right now is having like an all-time moment for people, they are the people that they're talking to, their customers, especially at Stripe, their focus is speed to market. They're like, build it and ship it based on its absolute core functionality, and then everything else comes down to the capabilities of the team in terms of delivering on the product and the ability for the company to make profit. And I thought that was really, really profound, which was, this is what the chap's name is Jeff Titterton. He's the CMO of Stripe. So I was, again, front row with him watching that. And he also said as well that although this gets spoken about less, that Airtable is still something that has a lot of capabilities and a lot of power, especially when you start looking at integrating data into Airtable. I'm not an Airtable expert. I do need someone to kind of give me the 411 on it, but that's something else that's crazy. And also, Stripe has created a service called Atlas, which actually helps companies set up. So to me, this is the Michelin model, which is it enables people to use their service. So you know where the Michelin guide comes from?
Yeah, it's from the drive that they took through Europe, right? And they did a tour of Europe, and all the restaurants that they viewed on that trip were part of that Michelin guide. Is that accurate?
The version that I was told, which blew my head off, I hope it's not folklore because you're generally not wrong about stuff, but the version that I was told was that Michelin started to review restaurants that were far away from population dense metropolitan areas with car owners because people just didn't need to drive anywhere. So what Michelin would do would be review restaurants far away from where people have their tires are, so more people use their tires, wear their tires down by traveling to all these places and therefore need to buy more tires.
So we're both right. They did it by driving through Europe, and that was their strategy.
Yeah, I don't know if I don't know. They might have selected the restaurants that way, but basically they told people like, look, you must go to this place to try this, and they highlighted places where you need to drive, and that was then allowing the treads to get, you know, more wore down. So I say that to say this, which is that Stripe created a company called Atlas, and Atlas is there to help companies set up. So if you can set your company up quickly, then of course you're going to be a candidate for using Stripe much sooner. So seeing companies bleed into their ecosystems and become facilitators of pre-product users is really, really interesting. But yeah, this no-code, low-code thing is something to really be looking at. And I would say that, honestly, if you're under 30 right now, you should be very, very mindful of the fact that if you're going to go and join an SME or a small business, you got to walk in there with a personal tech stack. So you got to be able to say to a CEO, hey man, I'm good at Notion, Slack, ChatGPT-4, da da da. And you've got to know what that is. And knowing, I'd even say like knowing 10 is not a good performance. Like you should know 20. No, obviously most relevant to the person you're speaking to, but you should really know that. Now, all of us already know things like Google Workspace and Gmail and, you know, the day-to-day stuff. But there are so many other apps that can do integrated things that it's really something that people should be looking at. And also, you'll like this, Adnan, that the CMO of Stripe said that when rolling out no code, low code, it should not be technical people that roll it out because they tend to like over leverage the technology. And it should be the process creators that roll out no code, low code and wrap the low code, no code software around the process rather than let the technology lead what it does. Does that make sense?
Yes, but I'm curious on what that impact would be like. Having, Is it that the developers skimp on the process or that I don't have a full understanding of the operations when they roll it out?
No, I think
over-engineered.
It's about the order. He said that when you get low-code, no-code capabilities like Notion, the people that run the processes inside the organization should decide what Notion should do and should start building it. Then the QA team, which is your dev team, people that have a much more like integrated eye on the dev side, can then come in afterwards and do the QA stuff, the quality assurance. Mm-hmm. So really, really, really good stuff. And also there was...
Well, it goes back to that speed to market question, right? Because ultimately, in many ways, you start off with the business side requirements that go to the tech team. And then there's always that back and forth that may take weeks, that may take months. And then ultimately goes back to the dev team, to QA. So why not have a business, like you said, create the minimum viable product using a low code, no code technology, send it to the dev team. They say, oh, this is good, this is good, this is good. Hey, here's an edge case that, you know, it's not built for. Great. Yeah. Roll it out.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And personally speaking, on every large company, the dev team has a list. There's this phrase that says, yeah, we'll add it to the list.
Mm.
And then they evaluate everything based on what they believe is a priority. And we've consistently seen that things that are initially flagged as low priority could end up becoming or truly are high priority, but they've not been fully fleshed out in that like low initial brainstorming or wireframing stage. Mm. Now, if a operations or a process oriented person can create minimum viable products of everything on that list that probably may or may not ever get done, you get to actually see it in action and better realize its priority and impact on the business, i.e. you get to better decide which in technology investments are worth spending the time on.
Mm. Mm. It's going to be really good to see how many new companies just start off with this. Like we saw this back in the day, 20 years ago, where companies were like, yeah, we're starting off like fully digitized. Like we send our invoices out digitally. We do this, we do that. And we're going to see a whole revolution as more of these technologies come to play. Another thing on AI as well, really quickly, which is interesting, is the impact of AI on online advertising. So at the moment, one of the chaps on stage made a point, which is that adverts are a proxy to your customer. It's a middle person. And if you can convey what you want to convey on that advert, on that asset, then hopefully the person that's consuming it, your potential customer, will understand what value you can bring to their lives and want to exchange their money for it. But he said, you don't go to Google Ads to buy an ad. You go to buy an ad that in turn generates traffic. So if you could go to Google, pay them and buy the traffic without an ad, you would. So that means that the money that you spend, you're not losing some of it testing your ads. So what we might find ourselves in a world doing is saying to an AI, hey, could you reach out to 30,000 customers, please, whose each of the AIs of those 30,000 customers have an interest in blue pens. Make sense? Because if an AI is your assistant, in the corporate world that I've been in, when we've done events, you tend to court the events team, the marketing team, the HR team, or the PAs of the CEOs. You court them. You say, hey, have you thought about somewhere to do your Christmas party this year? Hey, have you thought about somebody to make the uniforms in your business? So you court certain influencers to the decision makers. What kind of economy are we going to have where you're telling your AI to go and influence other decision makers' AIs to put a word in that decision maker's ear? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I know a CEO, and when he'd walk into the office, his PA would walk in once he'd got settled, and she would just reel off people that asked they wanted to see him today, phone calls that he missed, everything. Also, by the way, you mentioned that you want to put this off from last week to this week. If you want to push it through today, we can. Like, AI is going to do that. But if some fancy restaurant gets hold of that lady and influences her, she could influence the boss to do the Christmas party there or do the award show there. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So what is the economy of, at the moment, influencers influence other human beings? But what happens when we need to build an influencer strategy to influence the AIs of the people that are the AIs that are closest to the decision maker? And the fact that I'm stumbling my words here as I reel this off is an example of how little thought I think the world has had on this subject yet.
Yeah. So let me touch on this, because this is actually something I'd probably like to push back on and see what you think. Is for the same reason that I have a slight skepticism when I see a sponsored ad on Instagram, is the same reason why I have a slight skepticism when I see an influencer doing a paid post. Maybe the same reason I start becoming skeptical of certain AI recommendations if they are paid for by Raj Kateja and Inc. or whoever to influence me, right? The beauty of true influence is because it's an organic influence. Well, that's why I don't pick the first sponsored ad on Google. I go to the Google reviews. So that's my concern a little bit on the paid front.
So what if, I mean, we're already doing that with Gmail and Google, which is that if you were to pay for Gmail for an email client, a closed email client, you would probably pay $30, $40 a user for a closed lockdown email client. But you pay $5 a user with corporate Gmail because they want to drop you ads in as well. So it's going to be the same with AI. If you want to pay for absolute privacy and no distractions, you can go and get the luxurious AI. And it happens in all aspects of society, right? If you don't want to dine with everybody in a restaurant, you book the private dining room. But there's a minimum for that room. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, but if you want the generic, everybody can access it, but you've got to cope with the noise of everybody else talking in the restaurant, then that's you coping with the noise of your AI making some suggestions to you because you have an agreement with your AI provider that I'm okay with my AI to suggest me some bits and pieces if it saves me $30 a month.
Mm. So I think there where AI actually, now it's making sense to me, where AI will add its value is tailoring the messaging of the specific event location offer you have to the language, the style, and the exact moment where it knows that the specific user is most geared to buy or to be interested in it, right?
Yeah.
I don't think that Instagram or Google has that level of granularity on the data of the person that's using it. It just throws up a sponsored ad or an Instagram post.
Yeah, it does have stuff running in the background, but I think it's also the willingness as well for businesses to put data into the language model. So let's say, for example, Google reaches out to all of the restaurants on Google and says, hey, do you prepare your halal or kosher meat separately from the rest of the food in the kitchen? And the restaurant says, yes, these are our facilities. We do it separately. We have a separate kitchen for halal or kosher. That then gets uploaded to the LLM. And then a family comes from the Middle East to London and says, hey, we've got 4 nights out. We'd like to only eat in places where the halal meat is prepared in a separate kitchen. And AI goes, no problem. Here it is. Done.
Mm.
Super done. We talked about this a few episodes ago. Do you remember? The idea of interfacing with a shopping website by going through to every single product page, celery, apples, cucumbers, and then hitting plus one, add to basket, reviewing the basket, putting in your credit card details, even if it's one click Apple Pay, and then it giving you a delivery time, that's going to become extinct. Your AI is going to be like, hey, these are the things that you need. They're the exact same things that you bought over and over again. Shall I put the order in? You do not need to then go to the app of the supermarket on your phone. The AI will be the common interface. The same way that we interface with iOS, and then all of your apps are just guests on the operating system there to serve you.
Mm-hmm.
Each app is a member of staff, right? And your phone is your company. And each app has a job to do for you at your beck and call. All of those will be blended inside your AI, and your main operating system will be your AI. And that's the thing you'll interface with. And within there, there'll be APIs out to a whole bunch of other services that make your life easier, all waiting on your beck and call the way the apps do today. But they're 24/7, real time, talking to each other and learning from every other customer simultaneously. So the level of efficiency that we can reach with AI when it comes to tasks that are associated to connected devices, you're about to see an exponential impact in that.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Or is that like too weird?
No, that makes entirely a lot of sense. And as I think about like the impact of that, where I see the most opportunity, at least when it comes to the equivalent of a ChatGPT, is to improve the depth in which ChatGPT or any other language learning model can delve into a website. Like, you know, give me the top products on Amazon. Great. That's easy for ChatGPT. But I want to know, I want to buy a Kindle. I don't want to buy the newest model. I want to buy one before the newest model because I have XYZ price range. And I also want to make sure it's in stock in Dubai, UAE. And I'd like to have it before July the 10th because I'm heading out for the weekend.
Yeah.
And now is where ChatGPT needs to leverage either plugins or some other, you know, attribute that's built into it to start scraping around the internals. And now Amazon's a big website, but you want to create something more website agnostic that can literally use the code infrastructure that the website's built on, be it the HTML or CSS, and start digging around for the information you want at that level of granularity.
So you've definitely built the cake there and iced it. Let me just put a little cherry on top of the cake. We've both been in situations, I've been in this situation many times, where I've grabbed a piece of tech, bought a piece of tech late, shoved it in my bag, and then set it up on a plane or set it up in whichever country or resort I'm going to. The only thing that I would suggest to color that scenario in more is that it says, well, Adnan, you're waiting for this device on a Friday. It's a new MacBook, and it's going to take you ages to set up. Why wait at home for the MacBook? Hit the road, go to the resort. I'll have the MacBook sent there to your room. And you don't even know what room you're going to be in. But the Apple's AI, delivery AI, well, let's just call it AI in general, but the delivery function in it, will talk to the postal service, will talk to the AI of the hotel group that you're staying in, which will then talk to the AI of the local hotel you're staying in. And as soon as you get there and they go, oh, you know what, Mr. Bazrai, we're going to be upgrading you today, that all will feed back to Apple's AI. So when that MacBook arrives at your resort, the person doesn't even need to be told, what room are you in? They've all spoken to each other. He's in the room right now. And then eventually it'll get to the stage where it's like, hey, listen, on your watch, you'll just press a button or something, or you'll just tell your AI, listen, if important phone calls come up, this is the process when my MacBook arrives. I'm okay with Erica downstairs signing it for me. And you've given that indemnity to Apple. I'm happy for this hotel member to pay for it for me. I mean, sign for it. That's the level of granularity it goes down to, because the real things that you consider in your brain when push comes to shove and you're staying in the city and before you're not hitting your holiday until your MacBook arrives, that's the level of granularity that we're talking about, bro.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just thought through like the impact of that, seeing it on my phone alone. And like, there's just one little thing that I love about Apple, and the fact that it has, to a small extent, access to the other apps you've logged into. This is not necessarily an example of it, but it says, hey, you have a booking for dinner that I pulled through your Outlook Gmail. Do you want to set your phone on Do Not Disturb to make sure you're, you know, fully attentive and like immersed in that dinner? So just like your example where you were talking about having it sent to the hotel, I expect that these plugins or whatever that are built in ChatGPT will allow you to log into your respective Marriott or Hilton account, your respective Amazon account, your respective, you know, car rental company account. And that's how they start talking to the AIs. But then there's also going to be, you know, the whole concern and questions around privacy and data security, and all of that come up soon enough.
That kind of worms is going to be way bigger to solve, like to address, than anything we've had when it comes to just large scale data. Remember we used to call it big data? That was like the talk for a long time. Big data, big data, big data. Big data has been preparing for this moment forever. Like, this is the moment where big data goes from something that has to be manually turned over like soil and interrogated and put into plant pots to
effect. Big data requires human capital to work it.
Correct.
Now human capital is at a near zero cost, or soon will be with this, you know, giga cluster. So
yeah. And imagine what we did, you know, recently, as you know, you've worked on a project with us, with a data scientist, how much more efficiency we get from that data scientist, knowing that that person has a bunch of different tools. So whereas the data scientist price might not go down and our data scientist charges us a lot, what they come back with in the output could be just insane. let's move on to a few other little bits and pieces, because Adnan, as you know, I said I'm going to message this to all of our clients, this podcast, and to all of our, you know, smarter listeners. And I wanted to just kind of hit you with a few bullet points and see what you're interested in. I made a video about this. I don't think I've put it out yet, but the fact that one of the biggest trends in startup world at the moment is districts competing for startups. So we now have a very aggressive courting mating ritual going on between regions, geographic regions that are ran by councils and governments and startups. So here in Canada, I am literally seeing different parts of the Greater Toronto Area, different districts competing for startups. Like literally saying, like, if you go to Toronto, you'll get this. But if you come to our neighborhood, you'll get this. Like to our city or our district or our region. So I think that's one big trend. Another big trend is Nigerians, Ghanaians, and West Africans. Loads coming to the event, all doing super cool, interesting stuff. I've seen the evolution of tech go from, in the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years that I've been moving around these rooms, go from predominantly like old white males to younger people, and then bleeding into obviously people from different backgrounds, different races. I think Collision is probably one of the best representations of representation. People from every single part of the world, every single walk of life. But you do notice every time you go, which for me is every couple of years, a new population that's really sprung up. And, you know, just from the energy and the vibes that they're really doing their thing. A couple of years ago, I'd say like last time I went to Web Summit, it was definitely like women. I was like, wow, there's noticeably more women here. And that's something that Web Summit, the organizers behind Collision, Paddy Cosgrave and those guys, they're very proactive about seeding tickets to female entrepreneurs. And I think they might have even had 500 female run companies this year. It was a big number. But regardless, I'm seeing some excellent stuff happening out of West Africa. People just with their startups. And as you know, Paystack and places like that, those companies come from there. So that's sick. Educational establishments are doing more incubating and investing of startups, taking a slice of whatever the startup does if it continues to grow. Another big trend I've seen is brands moving over their charging system for their cars to Tesla protocol. So just straight up saving a bunch of money and saying, you know what, the capex associated to having our own charger, having our own charger network is too high. And the time that they build it out, Tesla could get an even bigger head start. So we'll just make the plug of our car a Tesla plug, and we will just be able to then use all Tesla infrastructure. So it looks like Ford, GM, and Hyundai might be possibly doing it. I think Ford might already be doing it. And Volvo is already doing it. So yeah. And also as well, like apparently from I don't drive an electric car, but apparently just from a straight performance point of view, as well as distribution point of view, is better. Now, in terms of bars, let me hit you with this one. That when you drive a car with an engine, there are inherent threats, right? Because when you drive a car, there is a combustion engine under the hood, slightly ahead of you as you're driving 140 kilometers an hour down the road. Mm-hmm. So engines have threats, natural threats that are the laws of physics. But firmware, which is what runs your car, also has threats. We've seen that with computers, right? And firewalls. So there is going to be a whole industry around a car firewall. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Beyond just an alarm, but what are the active computational events that are happening inside your car to prevent people constantly from trying to hack your car or steal it or do something bad to you whilst you're in your car? Make sense?
Yeah. So, no, that entirely makes sense. Yeah.
Every industry that spins off the back of firmware and software and hardware will also now be applicable to cars. And what was crazy is that the guy on stage said that when you're in a fossil fuel car, you're steering an engine. But when you're in an electric car, you're steering a computer. And I was like, damn. You see now, do you see now why I travel like 7,000 miles to come to these events? Is because you're literally in the room with the smartest cats in the world. Yeah. Just frame stuff a certain way. Like,
yeah, I know framing stuff a certain way is it. And that's been my experience also, Raj, with you, is like, I think about these things, but I don't frame them in certain times in the way you do. That helps me think about them in different ways, right?
Yeah.
So I want to touch on that Tesla point for a moment, actually, which is, I think the whole concept of charging infrastructure and charging speed is very, very important. Because when you think of what it takes to adopt electric cars as the mainstream, there are a couple of different variables, right? There's the price of the car. The average price of a car, regardless of if it's ICE or electric, is roughly about 37, closer to 37,000. Electric cars have reached that. You see everything from like the semi-electric on the Prius, the Bolt, the Tesla as well, you know, including the tax credit. It's hit it. We're good. You look at the mileage. How long do most people drive for on long drives? Somewhere around, you know, 4 hours before they hit a gas station. Yeah, some people drive more, but generally it's about that much. 300-350 miles is the average, or at least maybe slightly above average range of an electric car. So we've got ourselves on the mileage. Now the question is, when my mileage ends, do I have a place nearby to stop? And is it quick? And those are the two areas where electric cars essentially need to solve for to fully adopt themselves.
Mm.
And and as a result, because of the way the US is set up with, what is it? Electrify America. There's one other company, there's Tesla. And then there's, I believe it's like Ford's network as well. There may be four or five networks. Because there is no effective way to have a vehicle poured over through these networks, some form of consolidation, either through, you know, adapters, is not just a nice to have, but it is a requirement. Because we have been so accustomed to the gas station less than 5 minutes away model in the US.
But to your point, Adnan, the main thing is the interface. It's the nozzle. The nozzle is what makes everything ubiquitous. And then the transfer of cells, energy cells, which are liquefied straight in. Liquid moves very quickly, drops inside a tank and is ready to go. And it's the nozzle. So to your point, what you're talking about here is the charging interfaces, right? And is what you're saying that you're expecting like consolidation or adapters or what's your...
I'm expecting adapters, but then you also have to think, right? It's not just adapters. You have to have an integration across the system so that a Ford customer can effectively and quickly get billed for the energy they pull out of a Tesla station, right? Because if there's any friction between me scanning my phone at a pump, the first, the second, the third time I use a Tesla charger, one, it's going to make me not want to use the charging system in the future. And two, it's going to spoil my entire driving experience, right? Maybe I bought a Ford because I knew I could use this entire charging infrastructure and it doesn't work as I thought it would, right? So there's got to be a both sides of the coin thing. I want to go one step further as well. Let's say we solve that integration consolidation problem of charging infrastructure. It still takes you somewhere between 10 to maybe closer to 30 minutes to get a even charge up to like 80% on a Tesla at a supercharger. So there's two options here. Either we work our butts off and invest a ton of money into reducing that charge time, or we create the gas station as a space to do other things than just wait for 5 minutes. And I didn't really explain that too well, but what I'm trying to say is that I was at the annual shareholders meeting in 2022 where I saw Elon talk. And the one thing that I thought was interesting is that they were testing a gas station, a supercharging station. I believe it was in LA or somewhere on the West Coast that had a movie theater, like a drive-in movie theater and a pool. So let that sink in. Like, we are consistently working on improving the charging time, but at the same time, we are actually making the space that you wait while your car charges a place to enjoy facilities, amenities, and not feel the pain as much of the fact that it takes a little longer to charge.
Yeah, this is called bending time. This is the concept of time being a human construct in the mind. And when you're having a great time, time goes quickly. And when you're having a terrible time, it goes slowly. So what they're talking about here is the ability to at least make your brain be distracted from second to second, minute to minute. One thing that's wild here, and when you come to Toronto, I'll have to get you introduced to this. There's a gym here called Altea Gyms, A-L-T-E-A. And my cousin Neil, who I'm staying with, took me there. Bro, we walked in there. I didn't see no gym immediately. I saw a co-working space. I saw an arcade. It was effectively like you had to walk through the equivalent of like a cool Soho house for young people where all the beautiful people that work out in that gym are just working across different desks and stuff like that, or just chilling, hanging out in the restaurant. And then when you get to the back, then of course you've got a stunning gym because it's a high ticket place, you know? But the idea of walking into a place and feeling like you can do so much more is absolutely necessary, because what's happening is the company is taking responsibility for layering your time and making it more efficient, which is come and charge your car at the same time as having lunch, or come and charge your car at the same time as having a swim. And all of these things, if the lunch is healthy and the swimming is good exercise stuff, they also become brand indicators to the philosophy of the Tesla buyer. They'll be like, oh, well, Tesla buyers do care about health. So let's just pull up at the charging station, go for a swim, go for this, do that, take a few Zoom phone calls, and then jump back out again.
Yeah. And this is such a beautiful embodiment of a great framework, which is, hey, you're providing a product or a service. Analyze the psychographics and the characteristics of your customer. What is the other common service, lifestyle thing, product that they use? And then just find a way to vertically integrate to that to offer both.
And the unit economics.
That's why you saw gyms and coffee shops, right? This is just putting that on steroids.
Yeah, directly to your point, that the economics of a petrol station today is that the money made on petrol is negligible. It's when you go in and buy the chips, the soda, the Slurpee, the this, the that, you know, whatever it may be. That's where they make their margin, because that's traditional retail margin, if not slightly above traditional retail margin, because sometimes, as you know, in petrol stations, items cost more than they'd cost if you went and bought them from a supermarket or bulk. So yeah, that's what it's going to be. They're going to be like, listen, we're not effectively not making any money transferring your electricity into your car, but here's some other bits and pieces you can be getting along with. So I think that is really, really dope. And I think for Tesla, that will become more of a margin creator, and it'll just create more lifestyle, because you're like, well, hang on a second. If I switch from my Tesla to off-brand X, I now don't go and get to charge at the Tesla Lifestyle Center. You know what I mean? Charging is just one of the things that I can do there, as well as take meetings and other bits and pieces. So
yeah,
no, it's super interesting. Is there anything you just wanted to add, or shall I hit you with a few more bits?
No, you made me think about the other things. Like, what do we make short trips to do that are either errands or just things we need to sort out? Like, you can imagine masseuses, hair cutting salons, laundromats, all of these things could be commonplace at petrol stations, assuming that it takes us much more time and energy and money to reduce the cost, reduce the time to charge up of an electric vehicle.
Yeah, the idea of somebody who uses an electric vehicle charging it at a wellness center is genius. Like, go charge your car and at the same time get a manicure or a massage or a haircut or a beard trim, you know, whatever it may be. Like, that's super dope. In real terms, just some news here, which I thought you might find interesting. AT&T, the wireless provider network here in the US, has AI making sales in a call center. And on the coding side, they have AI working under the hood at AT&T, and they've seen productivity gains of 20 to 50%. Also, when AI is making a sale, AI uses knowledge from every sale to facilitate every future sale. So an AI sales bot can use the knowledge from every previous sale to facilitate every future sale and take in every single variable. What this means is that they've got certain products that they're selling that have gone from an effective cost of sale of $5 to 10 cents. And the only way they can attribute that 10 cents is the use of electricity and computing power.
Is it more of a chat type sales or is it voice?
It was on stage. Yeah. Didn't get into the details. I'm assuming it might be voice.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Which they very easy to do. I mean, with what was it, Google Duo as well? They've shown that works.
I mean, it's good. It's easy to turn text into voice, but to close a sale is different, because as you know, closing sales is an art and a science. You know, there is a dance involved in sales. But yeah, just some things just to get like our clients and our listeners' creative juices flowing. Next up, I saw original Internet Badman on stage, MKBHD. He was incredible, an absolute 10 out of 10 star that I'd like to work with one day. Like, incredible. He was on stage with some AT&T guy, clearly some sponsorship or something made that happen. But standalone, my man MKBHD was insanely smart. Every question that he was put on the spot for, and they weren't the hardest questions in the world, but they were still questions where your perspective matters. And yeah, he murdered it. It was incredible.
Were there any answers that you think would be relevant to me, to the listeners?
Yeah, he said, he asked the question about what our relationship will be like as a creative in terms of the way we collaborate with AI, and specifically what aspects of brainstorming, strategy, and refining your scripts will it help with. He said that there's too much emphasis being placed on the need to become a skilled prompter when everybody's already prompting on Google.
Mm-hmm.
We call it a search query, but it's a prompt. And I think that's wonderful as well, because I think I've spoken to you about this before. This echoes exactly what I've seen in previous decades. People say this is the death of the PC. But if you just think critically for a second, your phone is the most personal computer you have today. It was not the death of the PC. It was just a huge leap forward for the concept of a PC. So I like that a lot. What also was interesting as well is that this Inflection AI, the guy that I just showed you the picture of, Mustafa Suleiman, mm-hmm. there was a lady that said that she wanted to lose a bit of weight. She was the moderator. And the difference between Bard and ChatGPT is that when she asked them for a meal plan for 1,200 calories, they came back and said, here's a 1,200 calorie meal plan. Start eating it and you'll lose weight. Inflection AI didn't give her a 1,200 calorie meal plan and said, I'm not going to give it to you. It's not right for you. And it started dissuading her and recommended a 1,350 calorie meal plan. And then what was crazy is that it didn't give her what she wanted because it wouldn't be right for her based on her body type. So then what it did is it didn't give it to her. And then AI reached out to her the next day and asked her how she's doing. And did she try the 1,350? So way more human style behavior. And she goes, I was annoyed that AI didn't give me what I want because AI is meant to give me what I want. And she realized that with these future AIs, they're going to be much more human. They're going to be like, look, I'm not going to tell you how to do that because it's not the right thing for you. And then the next day it checks in and goes, hey, listen, how are you getting on? That's mad.
That's mad, but that also brings me to like that dystopian concept of what are the factors of the data that's helping the AI decide if something is right for me. And when you think if it's right for you, you think right for a community, right for a country, right for humanity.
Mm.
And I know that I'm kind of projecting out really, really far out, but you have now AI where it's making potentially things that could err on moral judgment calls.
Mm. You could say that. I mean, but it's quirky, right?
It's quirky.
It's another soft human thing. Like, for example, when ChatGPT gives you an answer, it writes from left to right, like the words are being spilled out, but the words are ready. They only drip the words out on the screen to make you feel like someone's typing it, because that feels like there's a human. That's a human behavior. Like, we write in that way. Speaking of AI as well, Dave Rogenmoser from Jasper was on stage. He was talking about AI will do, you know, Jasper is there to build copy for you, depending on what kind of copy you want. It said that it will be able to tailor content to personas, to whoever it's speaking to, which will help with multivariate testing. So when you put out 3 to 4 versions of an asset and then you just test it, and then whichever the best one is gets upranked and gets scaled. He did say that even though they run Jasper, they look at AI copywriting as a drafting tool and it needs human checking, at least as of today. And then he said that what they do as Jasper is they've got multiple LLMs plugged underneath them. Like, for example, you know, ChatGPT and many others. But they all hold your data privacy agreement, which means that the individual AIs will not get your data. Jasper will get it, and then we'll just send it down to whichever AI they need to get you the answer that they need.
Yeah.
So that was pretty dope.
Yeah, we touched on this yesterday. I think that's a fabulous idea where you essentially have one AI or AI tool that consolidates all the information from a variety of LLMs. And then that AI becomes an arbiter, maybe a consolidator, maybe a judgment call maker on which one is the right one or the most apt one. Because what's very interesting is essentially what ChatGPT's LLM is essentially a text generator overlaid, like essentially, let me get this right so I make sure I'm explaining it well. It's you create a text generator, but then you also overlay a system that makes a classification and a judgment on if that answer is right. Mm-hmm. Now you're overlaying another piece of AI that goes across a variety of answers and says which one is the best one to serve to this customer based on what they're asking or their unique characteristics.
Yeah.
So just like layering levels of classification, judgment, and predictions just makes the answer better.
And so that's a good point. Apps like Jasper will plug into all of the main AIs, but then tailor what those AIs are capable of in the context of their own platform and the agenda of their platform, which is to offer copywriting abilities. So again, you see this because ultimately content is such a big part of AI. We saw this in the beginning of the internet, which is you had search engines pre-Google, maybe even before your time, like AltaVista and Yahoo, and they would have everything on them from sports to cooking recipes to flights to everything else. And then over time, you had things like the tech crunches and the Skyscanners that are websites that do much more narrow jobs for you. And I think we're going to see that with AI as well. And one thing that this chap said is that GPT is good for like general on-ramping of an AI consumer to understand the concept of AI. But once they need more narrow things, they're going to go to split off AI arbiters or aggregators, as you mentioned, that will do something cool. So yeah, man, other things like Anthropic AI and all that is all plugged into Jasper. I thought that was dope. Also, one more thing before I forget. I'll end with this about the threat for conferences in general. Some other quick bullet points. Another talk, when it comes to financing at the moment, seed rounds are only down 15%. So there's still an appetite for seed investment to outperform the market. And Series D is down 30%. So there is not an appetite to put large capital into late stage startups pre-IPO, just in general. So that's where the investors are allocating at the moment. And also privacy. So I don't know if I told you about this when I was in New York. I took a picture, which I need to dig up and put into one of these micro videos, of I was in Brooklyn or somewhere, I can't remember where I was, and I saw two tech companies, and one was a digital poster and one was a physical poster, a paper one, which was Apple, both talking about privacy. And I think what's happening right now is that they're starting the privacy conversation. Anybody who touches any data, they're going to start the privacy conversation now. Because with money being deployed more narrowly, a lot of these tech companies have to be careful as to where they spend their money and what message they want to convey. And I think anybody that's been low-key collecting data for years and years and years and years, or data collection is part of what they do, it's necessary for what they do, which is most companies, then they're going to have to really start talking about privacy. So I think privacy, the same way that you've got like gut health and mental health in consumer content, I think privacy in B2B content is going to be really sexy and hot. And I think people are going to have to start paying some attention to it and start thinking about what are the stories they can put online about their approach towards privacy, the same way that a lot of companies put out content about their thoughts on sustainability or diversity or ESG, you're going to have a position on privacy, especially if you collect data. Because if one of your customers comes back to you and says, how do you use my data for this? How do you use my data for that? You're going to have to say, this is our policy. Actually, rather than risk me forgetting, I also wanted to make this point as well. I've been in the conference space for quite some time. We've done our own and other bits and pieces, as you know. But I did notice that there is a threat to conferences, because conferences are just live content platforms. And today, watching a talk on stage, a fireside talk where one person interviews another on two couches, is at a glance indistinguishable from a podcast that's going on the road and doing a live podcast.
Yeah.
Effectively, it's the same. We don't call it out for being that, but the reality is that the biggest threat to conferences at scale is the fact that their content is presented linear and real time, like television, which is you have to scramble to the stage, get a seat, and watch the talk. And typically, to keep that pace going, these talks are like, you know, 15 to 20 to 30 minutes. But those same people are actually going on other people's podcasts and doing deep dives in their subject area, an hour and a half. So effectively what you're doing is you're giving people a sample of your thoughts on stages at Collision. And if they're interested in you, they'll go and find more content about you, articles and podcasts, where they'll deep dive. So actually, this is more of a festival format. When you go to a festival, an artist comes out and does their hottest 12 minutes, right? Or their hottest 18 minutes. And off the back of that, you might Shazam them or Google them or go to a dedicated show where they'll come and do their full 90-minute show. So that's what I'm noticing is that the biggest threat from a cognitive and intellectual point of view is that you can get much richer information from the people on stage at places like Collision by just Googling them and going and listening to their podcast, and you can do it real time. It's much more convenient. But there are so many people that I saw on stage. I didn't really know who Mustafa Suleiman was. Now that I kind of got a chance to see him speak and kick it with him, I'm probably going to follow all of his podcasts. Do you know what I mean? Anytime that he speaks. So that's why I thought it was like some real fly shit. So it is a threat from the content point of view, but then of course you're still going to need these conferences.
Yeah. But ultimately, like I do agree to a certain extent. I think that conferences may shift to much more of the networking opportunity model, right? You got to spend some time with Mustafa Suleiman. Now, obviously I know you're well connected. That may not have been an opportunity that's afforded to everybody at that conference. But if you lean conferences towards giving someone the opportunity to have a personal conversation with the individual that they have watched multiple hours of podcast off, that's what it becomes, right? Like, I go to a festival to a certain extent because I like the artist, but there have been many more concerts or artists that I've been to purely because other friends have been going or groups of friends have been going, off which at the concert, I'm not even watching the artist for half the time.
Yeah, it's a very good point. Yeah, and I want to keep it separate. I want to keep the chance to meet people separate because that requires a physical gathering. Like you'll notice with My Friends, Your Friends, the whole genius behind My Friends, Your Friends is the website looks like a conference, but instead of speakers, you've got attendees. And I realized that when I was working for Bench Events, doing their content, running their media, that I would interview all of the big CEOs and the sponsors when they get off stage and whenever you catch them. And I noticed that every single one was like, the networking's great. Meeting people was great. And yet when I go into the rooms, the first day, the room's pretty busy. It starts off super busy for the opening keynote, and then it gets lighter as the day goes on. Then beginning of day two, a few hangovers, less people in the main room. And then by the end of day three, it's kind of pretty quiet. So people are speaking less and less about the sessions as the days go on, but they were always talking about the networking. And so you're right about that. And I just want to give another plug as well to Collision for this and Web Summit, because I've been rocking with these guys for a few years now. The parties that Collision threw were insane. And I can't say it's all Collision, because Toronto is one of the best party cities in the world, period. So Toronto came with it. The DJs here, the people, the venues, they are made for like music lovers. But yeah, the opening night, they did a place called, I think it was called Distillery District. It was dope. And then I didn't go to the second night because I had a catch up with a friend. And on the third night, they did it at a place called Stacked Market. And bro, it was a movie. Like, Collision's parties were insane. Like, it had elements of festival in there. It had just the coolest people. People were straight up dancing and raving. They had a beatboxer, like the Canadian's number one beatboxer. He was doing like Wu-Tang bits on stage. Like, it was incredible. Collision smacked it. And they made an announcement as well that they're going to be here next year as well. And honestly, bro, I think you can't come to a Collision and not get something. Whether you see, Collision's not going to win and do a royal flush on one thing, which is the programming of the stage content, because it's subjective. They're not going to do it on the people you meet, because that's a little bit of luck.
Yeah. But
between the people you meet, the stuff you see on stage, the parties you go to, and just the overall vibe and energy, you cannot not get an ROI from going to like Collision or Web Summit. Like, I'm dead ass thinking about like doing the Lisbon one as well, because it's
There's one happening next year in Qatar, right?
Qatar, which I think we need to have a conversation about.
What I'm really excited about, going back to the start of that conversation, is you talked about Collision and a variety of these conferences getting more and more diverse. More and more every day, I am blown away by how diverse this area of the world is. And you specifically say your Dubais, your Abu Dhabis, potentially soon your Saudis, as well as Doha, Qatar getting there. So I'm excited for the level of diversity of ideas, of opinions, of cultures, of political, you know, viewpoints as well that we will see at the conference next year.
Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to throw this in as well, that the idea of, I'm sorry we're bouncing around a lot. I'm definitely apologies to the listener, because you're getting, it's like a montage, this one. But it's also just based on my notes. On AI as well, at the moment we talk about large language models, and language is mostly text and voice. Mm-hmm. But where AI is already going right now is other modalities and vectors, including gestures and like facial recognition. So the idea of just like having an LLM, is language-based LLM, is going to be out of fashion very soon. And the reason, the example that they gave is that the kind of data that we convey as humans is so much more than language. And the way that we communicate with children is pre-language. So children have to take so much more data, from like a hug to a look to a smile to a this to a sound to a peekaboo to whatever it may be. So these are all things that are being conveyed. And if you really think about it, it's light data, isn't it? The light hits your parents' body, bounces off your body, goes into your retina, is interpreted, and then your brain responds accordingly. So if you look at the true richness of data that happens through human communication and expression, AI is just at the beginning of that and is going to try and address that as time goes on. Mm. So
that's fascinating.
So yeah, that's on that front. And bro, there's so much. You know what I would say to any of our listeners and to any of our clients? If you want to get into a deeper conversation about this, just drop us a message. You know, head over to Raj at Creative Content Agency or Adnan at Creative Content Agency, and just drop us a message. And we can, you know, if you're doing something, you're investing in this space, or you want to have a chat about something, you'll get some insights from us, or have us come in and do a workshop in your organization, then holler at us. We can make that happen. Also, another brilliant thing, there was this Asian fella, I forget his name, but he's a huge TikToker. He's a big star there. Mm-hmm. And in general, dude, a lot of content creators, not a lot, but there was some content creator programming, like MKBHD and this Asian chap. They were mm-hmm. really like rock stars because of the kind of audiences they built. This chap yeah. that he was talking about, very bright guy, he did say something quite simple. He goes, do you go long form or short form with your content strategy? And he said, long form is to build an audience with depth and convert them. Short form is to build exposure and a wider audience, which is what we teach anyway. But mm-hmm. I was just nice to hear like a super accomplished TikToker come out and say that. And it's weird that the traditional corporate tech industry doesn't understand the nuances and the empathy of the creator class. So when you look at the questions that tech leaders ask creators, for us as creators, it seems very simple, but there is still a huge transfer of knowledge that needs to happen between the creator class and the tech class. And that's really ironic, because the tech class enabled the creator class.
100%.
So it's so something to keep an eye on, I'd say, like something to be aware of. And bro, I don't know how much more should we go into more, or should we just kind of like say, yo, this is crazy, and just call it a day?
I think this is a lot of good information that I think our audience will enjoy. Mm. Let's save the rest for next week, because I know there's more we can discuss. I mean, I'm even holding back from kind of opening up and unpacking each of these points. So
no, do it now whilst we're on the call, because then at least we'll never be able to come back to it. If there's anything yeah. pressing you want to ask about, I mean, dude, I've got points for days. One person said, you know, banks have been using Dear Mr. Bazrai, and it's signed off by, like, you know, Linda, your bank manager, your head of customer service experience.
Yeah.
They go, like, humans are not going to be freaked out by AI communicating with them, because yeah. the version of AI that we live in at the moment is automation and personalization. Yeah. So when you get a letter through the door, you know that somebody didn't manually type out your bank details on that letter.
Yeah.
It was just a data field, and it got populated, which is like, this is his first name, this is his last name, this is his account number, this is his address. Mm. It gets printed to a piece of paper and sent to you. So you consume it in a personalized or tailored way, but you don't assume that was manually written by that person. Even if it's signed off by somebody at the bank, you know that they didn't write that. So our tolerance for just being on the receiving end of a brand that's just trying to get its point across is really, really high. And of course, there's a lot of things around, this is probably something we can say for another day, but unintended consequences and AI being used for like war, for producing like machines.
Yeah. Oh my God. I do want to touch something on those creators. And because I was listening to kind of an in-depth podcast around the business model of a company called Spotter, which essentially, I don't know how much you know about them, but they essentially provide financing for creators. So they help them scale up and grow. And there are two notes really. One is the fact that, you know, creators don't really have a great relationship with the traditional financing organizations. And that's purely out of a, just like you mentioned, a lack of, you know, communication, understanding of the dynamics of the creator world, right? Like any form of financing has a high level of volatility towards it because you just may not know about any of the 200 external circumstances that could affect a specific video succeeding or not. So what Spotter does is essentially, one, it slates its creators that it finances. So that volatility is already reduced when you have a set of 15, 20 creators applying for financing. But the real interesting thing, and this may seem standard to somebody, was it blew my mind, was the fact that, yeah, I want to provide you $1 million of financing on your next video because you want maybe a new warehouse, you want to fly your team to another city to record something. I cannot predict if that video will fail or, you know, succeed. But what I can predict is the long tail of views and exposure and ad revenue that your existing 50 videos will continue to generate because I have the data on what they have generated so far. So what they do is they say, we will take the, you know, potential generated cash flow from your existing videos and use a portion and use a portion of that to fund your future videos. So your existing videos become the collateral on the future. And then over time, as you can, what they've noticed is they have been able to effectively do multiple deals with similar creators, because what happens is as they get better at predicting, both using their own data sets and AI tools, in predicting those generated cash flows, they can offer better amounts and accurate financing going forward to each of these creators. So genius. Slating it.
It's genius.
It's absolutely genius.
It's genius. It's a mortgage.
Yeah, essentially it's mortgaging creators, which is incredible. And they've worked with some pretty big names in the business, you know? So well, I think if banks and just general financial institutions are going to get closer to creators and understand these dynamics of where you can essentially create DCF models for videos, merch sales, whatever other assets these creators create, you can use it to actually generate a lot of revenue from the potential that they can generate in the future.
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost like a 360 model, right? You throw in a talent agency and take a slice of that action as well as a loan generator, as a loan mm-hmm. allocator. You could make your money back in that kind of way. Yeah. Super amazing. Dude, there's so much more stuff, bro. I wish I could just get into this. I went to this interesting talk with some folks out of Hong Kong that do stuff in Hong Kong, and they were like, everything isn't about scale. If it was, every restaurant would be McDonald's. And they're seeing a realization that people are now starting businesses with smaller total addressable markets and just being very open about the fact that they're going to produce in a scarce way. And their objective is just to be able to run a company of 12 people and that's it, and get everyone retired in 5 years and exit. So, and they also said as well that it's hard to be sustainable if you're trying to scale, because scaling can crush sustainability, because sustainability is about balance between inputs and outputs and supply and demand, and scale is about scrambling that. I was like, genius.
Yeah,
so I hope there was some insights there, dude. Maybe what we can do in the future when we get other folks on the call, and this was an hour and 13 minutes, and I don't think there was 20 seconds where we weren't, you know, putting across something hopefully meaningful or valuable to our listeners and to our clients. But man, there's a lot to cover, and we're in a very interesting time in technology. I've not seen this vibe since smartphones started to drop. And prior to that, I'd not seen this vibe until broadband was being like put into our homes. This is on that scale. This joins broadband, wireless internet, smartphones, the cloud. It joins mobile phones. It joins all of that as like the big shifts in society. AI is definitely about that. So I hope it was useful for anyone who's listening. Adnan, did we miss anything, or is there anything, any little closing bits and pieces that you want to throw in about stuff that you've seen that's interested you this week? I think we'll just leave all of the cool shit that I've been doing in Toronto for another episode.
Yeah, no, this covered a lot, and I think that there's enough juicy information for any listener to literally take notes.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I only got through about half of mine.
Yeah, and guys, if you have any feedback on things that you think that we have, you know, maybe can delve deeper into, things that we can consider, things that we maybe even potentially didn't take into account, share it with us. We'd love feedback. We'd love your thoughts, and, you know, we wanted to continue this conversation outside of just a pod.
Hit us on Threads.
Yeah.
Did you get your Threads account?
Yep, got it on, man.
Can you give me your initial?
I didn't have a Twitter before this, so it's given me kind of a really cool opportunity to do stuff with text that I never did before.
Wait. You never had Twitter before? That's interesting. What's your experience like with the Threads media format? For anybody who's not on Threads yet, effectively, at a glance, it's effectively Twitter. It's something which allows you to use your Instagram login to put a piece of text in, and inside there you can put other bits of media. And what they've done, guys, is they've inverted what your anchor piece of content is. On Instagram, your anchor piece of content is an image or a video, and then the text accompanies it. On Threads, they've inverted it, which is your anchor piece of content is a piece of text with some additional rich media, which you can put in, as you can do on Twitter, to merchandise and make that piece of content, that post, more elaborate. So I would love to know, with you experiencing this type of publishing and this type of content creation for the first time, not being a Twitter guy, what your thoughts are.
It's good. I mean, I know that's incredibly simple, but I want to touch on like what I think I'm using it for. What it allows me to do is almost not have a different personality, but showcase a different part of my personality. And I have a lot of thoughts I share here. You do as well. And this was a really interesting conversation I had with Vic. Like, I don't really like talking about the things that come up to my mind, the analysis I make in front of camera with my face, but I love talking about it on text or on voice. So this gives me the opportunity to essentially have a different personality in some sense on Instagram than I do on Threads. Instagram is a lot about like fitness stuff, holidays, time with family, friends. And then on Threads, I'm mostly discussing data, aerospace, fitness, and potentially some AI stuff. So it's purely just me bringing my thoughts on paper around topics that care matter to me.
What were your did you see on the terms and conditions, of which there was three prominent ones, that Threads will be used, your login will be used, and it'll eventually be available as part of the Fediverse, and you'll be able to use your credentials that you're establishing on Threads in places like Mastodon? Did you see that when you hit accept?
No.
It was right in the middle of the screen. I think a lot of people were gassed and they just moved past it and they don't understand what a Fediverse is or what Mastodon is. These are the environments that Facebook is interested in creating and transitioning into. But there's also, to our point earlier on today, Adnan, is that Facebook is a place where a lot of text has been shared, but there's a lot of like nefarious action going on there. I think what Instagram is trying to do with Threads is just create another place where they can collect data and insights on internet users. Because look at what happened. I think they got in the first, it was the fastest growing network. Within 5 hours, they got a million. I don't know what it
means. So let me touch on that for a second, because you brought up a good point. Like, this is something I wrote down. It's like, Instagram simply needs to transfer over and retain 19% of its existing monthly active user base on Threads to surpass Twitter. And off that 19%, 3% have already signed up in the first 7 hours. So the way I see it, worst case scenario, Threads is the leading platform in 1 week. Best case, 72 hours.
Wow. Great take. I love it. That's really good. But can I ask you, though, do you think that Threads is a... Let me phrase this right, because if I do, it'll be easier for everyone to understand. Do you think that Threads is a honey trap language model? Do you think it's an offering that Meta has made to the people so that they can learn more about people, and everything that you put on Threads will eventually feed Meta's LLM and Meta's AI? Because look what happened, bro. Like with so many new things that Instagram does, they launch a new feature or Meta launches a new platform. we as internet users that are in the world of getting attention, especially as brand builders, we run on there and start putting our best stuff on there, not realizing that on an individual basis, we are the product and they're trying to collect as much as possible. So if Instagram, if Meta's AI was totally dictated by their three biggest platforms, WhatsApp, Facebook, and Instagram, well, that's a lot of insight. But none of them dominate when it comes to straight text, LM, like the language model. And now they've just been like, hey, guys, come and give us all your thoughts in text form. And what do? We do it.
Yeah. And the answer is yes. And I'll give you roughly three reasons. One, Instagram is not necessarily the leading platform when it comes to social media content. So it's an effort to stay relevant and keep collecting that data with an increasingly new set of user bases that are younger and younger. Two, there are a lot more people that like to express their thoughts, opinions, and perspectives on things in text than they do in person or in video or photo format. So you're growing potentially your user base. And then the last third one, and this is kind of the lower priority one, is that generally I would say from a bandwidth standpoint, it's easier and potentially quicker to parse data that's in text form than scrape through video or an image to identify topics of conversation or topics of interest.
Yeah. And again, they've just said, come and they've just put a donation pot out. They've literally just put a bowl outside their house and said, literally leave your 2 cents. That's what they've done with Threads. Like, what is a thought? They say, I'm giving my 2 cents. They've put a donation bucket outside the head office of Meta and everyone's coming along and throwing in their 2 cents. What happens if millions of internet users start putting their 2 cents into this pot that some of them have already been accustomed to putting it into the pot that is Twitter? That pot's going to get full pretty quick. That pot's going to become valuable as millions of people every hour put their 2 cents on Threads. And then
it's a legal way to steal your competitors' data too. That's another interesting point.
It's not necessarily stealing your competitors' data, but it's giving the same user base that your competitor uses another platform that effectively could offer more value than Twitter. Because what's been amazing, and it makes you wonder if Facebook for the last 6 months have been pumping this story for the last year, is the toxicity of Twitter and the toxicity of Elon being in charge of it. How much of that has come from as a result of Facebook funding PR companies and lobbyists to push that narrative so that they can come along with this great white knight that is Threads. So much to think about. My battery's dying. Adnan, thanks for bringing that into the loop as a conversation. And thanks for guiding today's conversation in a really super way that I'm sure will introduce a lot of topics to our listeners and hopefully get some meaningful conversations going with us this summer. Hopefully by next week, guys, we'll have a bunch of us on the call on the podcast. And we may even have a new brand to announce. If we do, be there for it. We might be doing a little bit of building in public, which you've never seen us do before, I don't think. We're building an incredible offering to the market, very close to what we've been doing already with Creative Content Agency, but the beefed up version. And it's really, really excellent. I can't wait to talk about it. We've been working behind the scenes intensely for a couple of months now, right, Adnan? On getting this right. It's been slow cooking in the oven for 3 years. So you're going to get something really wonderful, a new brand. It's going to join My Friends, Your Friends. It's going to join CCA. It's going to join Algo. It's going to join everything else. It's going to go up there and kick it. So we're excited to share it with you. And then we'll be reaching out to businesses and say, yo, partner with us because it's going to be successful. So hopefully you can get involved. All right, guys. Hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, hit that share button. Send it to somebody else that's smart. Likes and comments if you see it on YouTube, super beneficial. Subscribe and hit the follow button on Spotify. It's not for everybody, this podcast, but for those who it's for, we're super grateful for your attention. Oh, and I'll end with this as well. This is a little bar that I picked up last night, that when you do B2C content, you're fighting for people's attention. But when you do B2B content, you're fighting for people's concentration.
Ooh, I'm going to have to let that sink in.
It's a hard bar, right?
Yeah, it's a hard bar.
I realized, I was like, hang on a second. I was like, fleeting attention doesn't tend to serve our clients super well. Or it has low nutritional value. Whereas if you get concentration, that's typically a nutrient dense form of attention.
Yes.
Where more stuff can happen with it. We'll explore that concept and more in future episodes. There's a lot going on. Thanks so much for listening, Adnan. You're the best, dude. Appreciate you setting up this. And we'll speak to you guys next week. Peace.
It's been great. Peace.
All right, wicked.